Have you received your fill of college basketball yet, with all those March Madness games over the weekend? Are you ready for the Easter Bunny? Are you excited about April? Look, I'm not trying to stress you out with the flurry of questions. It's just a fun time of year, and I want to make sure you're taking it all in. You being a constant listener, I hope, and me being your host, Nick DeOlias, and this being the far middle in episode number 149er. This episode will cover a single consistent theme from start to finish. The theme of this far middle chapter will be manipulation. Every connection from start to finish. And when I was preparing for this episode, thinking about manipulation got me playing a song over and over in my head for some reason. The Rod Stewart song, Infatuation. Manipulation, infatuation, five syllables each. I suppose that's what's going on in my head. And why I'm connecting those two, and the song looping in my head, it's been a mental form of hiccups. Hey, let's hit our sports dedication. Someone or something consistent with manipulation, and a subject who, or that, if not a person, transcended sport. Well, we have an appropriate dedication subject that meets that tricky criteria pairing. He had a nickname. It was The Brain. And he did bad deeds and operated within and frankly ran the underworld. Not a good guy or upstanding citizen. He was also a mentor of sorts, and not in a good way that, say, the CNX Mentorship Academy looks to mentor young adults. No, this person mentored instead what would become a generation of the most infamous criminals and gangsters in our nation's history. Mobsters who were his contemporaries, or maybe were leaders of that next generation of the mob, that came after our dedication subject. You know the names that our dedication subject taught. Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Frank Costello, and Bugsy Siegel. Episode 149's dedication is to the diabolical criminal mind of Arnold Rothstein. So you might be wondering, which sport did Arnold Rothstein excel in before he became a criminal? After all, this is a sports dedication. But Rothstein didn't excel in any sport as a player or coach, to the best of my knowledge. However, he did something in sport that transcended the sports world. Yes, the brain, Rothstein, was the mastermind behind the fixing of the 1919 World Series. That's the most famous sports gambling fixing incident in the history of the United States. The stuff that movies have been made of, like Eight Man Out, the stuff that kept legends out of Cooperstown's Hall of Fame for a century, like Shoeless Joe Jackson, and the type of activity that remains a concern today in our world of big-time sports wagering and the tens of billions of dollars that flow along with it. I'm assuming that the brain indeed did fix the World Series in 1919, but I have to tell you in fair disclosure that the topic of his involvement has been debated for over 100 years since the series itself. No one knows for sure at this point, but boy, the evidence points heavily to Rothstein playing a major role in fixing the series. In 1919, Rothstein's minions may indeed have paid players on the Chicago White Sox to throw and intentionally lose the World Series to the Cincinnati Reds. Rothstein bet against the White Sox and made a significant profit in what was ended up being called the Black Sox scandal, to contrast against the official team name of the White Sox. The brain was summoned to testify before a grand jury investigation of the incident. Rothstein swore he was simply an innocent businessman, intent on clearing his name and his reputation. The prosecutors could find no evidence linking Rothstein to the affair, and he was never indicted. I wonder what today's prosecutors in places like New York would do with someone like Rothstein. Would it depend, perhaps, on his political affiliation? But I bet Rothstein played both sides of the political spectrum to cover his bets, so to speak. And I'm not going to speculate what playing in politics would equate to for a guy like Rothstein. What was interesting is that Rothstein did acknowledge the World Series was indeed fixed. Everyone knew that. His point was that it was not him that fixed the series. He testified in court. The whole thing started when some other cheap gamblers decided to frame the series and make a killing. The world knows I was asked in on a deal, and my friends know how I turned it down flat. I don't doubt that Attell used my name to put it over. That's been done by smarter men than Abe. But I was not in on it, would not have gone into it under any circumstances, and did not bet a cent on the series after I found out what was underway. That's from Rothstein's testimony. Another possibility was that Rothstein was approached by yet another gambler looking to fix the series and then wanted to find a way to manipulate those different gamblers trying to influence the outcome of that World Series. It would not be below Rothstein to figure out one mobster or gambler was fixing the series and then to bet on the series with the inside knowledge of the secret. And by the way, Rothstein was not in Cincinnati or Chicago for the series. He stayed in New York listening to a live broadcast of the games on a hotel or at a hotel. The players, including Shoeless Joe, they signed confessions of the fixing of the game, but all those signed confessions disappeared. And then the players refused to repeat their confessions. So the judge had to dismiss the case against Rothstein. How convenient. That's right. The official record says Rothstein was never involved in the fixing of the series. And the official record shows it was never proved that the series had been fixed itself. Despite the legal case against the White Sox players being dismissed, all eight White Sox players named as trial defendants, they were permanently banned from playing or participating as coaches in Major League Baseball by the newly named first commissioner of Major League Baseball, Kennesaw Mountain Landis. He sits in Cooperstown today. Now, what did Rothstein allegedly collect from betting on the fixed World Series? Well, there's a lot of speculation on that topic. He always maintained it was less than $100,000. Most experts say it was around $350,000. Most say it could have been much, much more. Now, the career didn't end well for the Brain. Rothstein was murdered in a business dispute, but he became immortal in the minds of Americans. Do you want an example of how he's become immortal? Do you like The Great Gatsby? A lot of people love that book. F. Scott Fitzgerald's 1925 masterpiece has in it a character named Meyer Wolfsheim, and he is a mentor to Jay Gatsby, who Gatsby tells Nick Carraway in the book fixed the World Series back in 1919. And Carraway wonders how that person isn't in jail. They can't get him, old sport, Gatsby replies. He's a smart man. Our episode 149 dedication goes to Arnold Rothstein, that diabolical manipulator. On to the connections for the week. Rothstein would famously quip that he would bet on anything except the weather, because you can't fix the weather. That's a good one. But you know what? Today, you can certainly manipulate weather data, if not the weather, and energy data and forecasts. We see this manipulation all the time, and it's used to justify and drive trillions of dollars of capital flows into tackling climate change. Now, perhaps the most egregious example of this data manipulation and forecasting manipulation currently is with the International Energy Agency, or the IEA. The IEA was established in the mid-1970s by the United States and other oil importers across the globe to better forecast energy supply and demand and thus improve energy security. The mission of the IEA was to provide objective and authoritative data and analysis as to where energy markets were going, so that countries like the United States could better prepare and manage the future. Times have changed, and so has the IEA. In recent years, the IEA has succumbed to ideological pressures from the left and the radical environmental movement and the Code Red crowd. It no longer fulfills its original mission, and in many ways, it acts to counter its original mission. Where the radical environmental movement pressured the IEA to manipulate its forecasts was with showing that the future would result in demand for more natural gas and oil across the globe. The Code Red crowd can't have that. That's a bad optic for them. So it pressured the IEA to make sure that its forecast no longer showed increasing demand for fossil fuels like natural gas and oil. Simple. Now, that projection myth, once published by the IEA and subsequent to the pressure that was placed on the IEA, it was then fed through an echo chamber whereby the media and the environmental movement, they pointed to the IEA forecast that they forced as evidence that we don't need to invest any more with capital into the forecasted to be obsolete oil and natural gas sectors. That's right. The same interest groups, the same ideologies that pressured the IEA to manipulate its forecasts are the same ones that then use those forecasts to hold up and point to the world saying, see, the IEA says we were right. Don't need any more investment in what is a declining demand forecast for natural gas and oil. Unreal, but at the same time, very real. And the most recent example of this echo chamber dynamic is with the Biden administration justifying what they are calling their pause on new LNG, liquefied natural gas, export facilities. Officials in the administration, they point to those IEA forecasts, the same ones that they pressured the IEA to manipulate, as justification as to why the pause on LNG export investment makes sense. Meanwhile, of course, the opposite is true. And that's what you get with manipulation. The original manipulation that one sees with things like the IEA projections, it then manifests into next order derivative manipulations, one of which is our next connection. Last episode of the Farm Middle, we discussed how the farmer movement in Europe is calling, you know what, on net zero plans and climate policies. Well, much of that turmoil kicked off in Germany, because the German government originally looked to manipulate its budget. You see, the government had some excess funding left over from pandemic emergency spending. And with the pandemic being over, the government wanted to utilize that excess budget, which was billions of euros, to spend on climate change programs. But the Constitutional Court in Germany said not so fast. And in late 2023, the court ruled that such a maneuver would violate Germany's constitutional amendment requiring a balanced budget. Now, talk about a great idea. I'd love to get such an amendment here in the United States, but I'm not going to hold my breath on that one. Anyway, when the court in Germany didn't allow the German government to manipulate its budget in such a way, the German government wouldn't dare to stop spending on these climate follies or net zero mythical plans. That would be too sensical and too logical. No, instead, that's when the German government decided to try to remove subsidy to farmers for diesel fuel and agricultural vehicle investments to help pay for the climate spending follies. And that was the spark that started German farmers to go on their tractor convoys and blockades. Yeah, it all started with budget manipulation by the government in its quest to keep spending exorbitant amounts of climate change dollars on policies while hiding that spending under cover of emergency pandemic funding. Manipulation by government is not unique to Europe. Our own government here in the United States is fully capable of manipulation of its own, as our next connection will show. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, it tells us that electric vehicle rules, which are effectively mandates, they're going to save and benefit Americans not billions of dollars and not hundreds of billions of dollars, but trillions of dollars. And the media happily accepts that prognosis with no questioning at all. You can trust the government, right? Well, not so fast. Thankfully, two authors, Paul Boniface and Tim Considine, they performed an analysis of the EPA electric vehicle rules, and found that instead of $1.6 trillion in savings or benefits to society that the EPA says will come from its electric vehicle rule/mandate, such a rule instead creates $1.4 trillion in costs to Americans and society. Now, that's quite the swing of about $3 trillion. And when you read the article, which is titled Analyzing the EV Rule, you see the EPA didn't just manipulate the total manufactured savings or benefits, but it got wrong and manipulated just about every line item used to construct the fabricated benefits and savings. The EPA overestimated savings from liquid fuel costs, and it underestimated electricity costs, which combined took what should have been about a $140 billion cost to society due to the electric vehicle rule to a fabricated or manipulated benefit of almost $900 billion. The fuel savings manipulation resulted in almost a $1 trillion swing by itself. But the fuel savings manipulation, believe it or not, was only one of the largest line items of manipulation in the EPA analysis. We must give some distinction to another line item that the EPA massively manipulated in the analysis, which was vehicle technology costs. The authors illustrated how what should have been over a $1.2 trillion cost to society using data provided by the government itself, ironically, was presented by the EPA as a $280 billion cost. That's another nearly $1 trillion swing via the manipulation. Now, a funny sidebar in the EPA analysis is how it viewed a $7,500 tax rebate for purchasers of EVs as a reduction in purchase price. Now, that might be true for the purchaser, the consumer who's buying the car, but it conveniently ignores the fact that the taxpayer pays for that $7,500 rebate. It's not free, and it certainly isn't a net benefit to society. And it's a net cost, frankly, to taxpayers. When you add it all up, as Boniface and Considine have done, the math shows what EPA presents as a $1.6 trillion benefit to society with the EV rule is actually a $1.4 trillion cost to society. Yes, manipulation can camouflage the negative as a positive, and it can do so on a massive scale spanning $3 trillion. Manipulation, finance, trillions of dollars, and government as the perpetrator. Hey, it's not just happening with the electric vehicle rule and with the EPA. It's also happening, as our next connection shows, with a slew of governments on the local and state level with public pension liability. If you look to official government and business media estimates as to the magnitude of public pension underfunding across this nation, you're going to typically find ranges between $1 trillion and $1.5 trillion. But a pair of economists from the Hoover Institution, they did their own analysis and they found that the funding shortfall as of 2021 was about $6.5 trillion, which is 600% more than the reported amounts that I just quoted. The manipulation of the public pension liability tab comes down to what government entities and their actuaries, those are the entities and individuals that calculate the liability, what they're using for discount rate to value future pension payments. Since most of these plans are pay-as-you-go, they should use much lower discount rates than what they actually apply, which, by the way, they typically use around 7%. And that's what skews the calculation of liability lower, as I said, by trillions of dollars or by almost 600%. And what is devilishly ironic with this manipulation is that the federal pension law and accounting standards, they force the same actuaries to use more appropriate discounting rates for private sector pensions. But those laws and those rules don't apply to state and local governments. So how do you like that? So the actuaries and the Government Accountability Standards Board, they keep pretending and manipulating by using discount rates that lower the reported public pension liability totals. If a public corporation engaged in such manipulation with their pension plan, they would be accused of misleading the capital markets and shareholders. But when state and local governments do this, they don't face accountability, pun intended, for misleading the American public and taxpayers. In fact, governments and their actuaries, they're quite brazen about what they do with discount rate manipulation. They develop and promote messaging and podcasts and conferences and presentations to criticize and downplay these types of concerns regarding the manipulation of public pension liability toward lower levels. It's a PR campaign designed to justify the manipulation. And by the way, I dedicate a chapter of my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, on this topic and issue. Give it a read if you get a chance, with a chapter on public pension liability. Now, I've been beating up on the government and its various modes of manipulation. So in the interests of fairness and balance, let's make a connection to manipulation to mislead public capital markets that's occurring in the real estate sector, specifically in the commercial real estate sector. We've discussed on the far middle how commercial real estate is facing an epic looming crisis. Downtowns are dying, businesses are shedding leases and office space, interest rates and the loans that go with them are increasing in costs, and many areas saw an overbuild in commercial real estate capacity. So you'd think that most of the financial reports and information that are provided to the capital markets to help investors make informed decisions, that they'd reflect this growing wall of worry and pending doom. And you would be wrong, because the commercial office real estate market has become quite adept at manipulating the value of individual properties through certain tactics used with transactions upon sale of properties. Allow me to explain how the scheme works. One company sells an office tower to another entity, and the seller wants or needs to show as high of a valuation as possible for the sale of the building so that it doesn't bring down the valuation of its entire portfolio that consists of similar buildings in similar areas. So how do you artificially manipulate and boost the value of an office building when you're selling it? Actually, it's quite simple. You ask the buyer to pay a premium for the building above market, and in return, you pay part of the acquisition price back as the seller by selling the debt on that building to the new buyer at a severe discount to market. And maybe when you're doing so, you don't disclose the discounted debt transaction when the seller, who is, let's say, a public company, releases its earnings report to Wall Street, or when it issues its press release celebrating the sale. Another way the scheme works is to manipulate the value of leases tied to the building in question by having the tenant pay a higher than market lease rate, but then entering periods of no rent payments or handing out cash to the tenant to net out the lower market-based lease rates. The lease rates are used to set the amount of money that can be borrowed against the building, to value the building, and also it's used to get a read on how profitable a real estate firm or public corporation might be. So it's always tempting for some entities to manipulate those lease rates to be as high as possible, higher than actual, higher than market. And the data show the behavior of manipulation using these tactics is increasing in commercial big city real estate markets. A commercial real estate executive in New York City quipped, "They figure out how to have 1 and 1 equal 3. That's an interesting quote, and some might call that lying, and some judges in Manhattan might call that fraud, with a penalty totaling in excess of $300 million if the defendant was a certain ex-president. But you know, we shouldn't be surprised of such shenanigans and manipulation in government or in the capital markets. When you consider the monetary manipulation that has been not the order of the day, but the order of the decade, heck, the order of the past 2 decades in the United States. That's our next connection. The Federal Reserve has set interest rates far below normal for decades, resulting in negative real interest rates. And such monetary manipulation has massive ramifications across society, much of them negative, and it makes it easier to run a business, and that creates an economy that inflates, but that will inevitably see its bubble burst. It creates and then incentivizes wild asset speculation in capital markets, and real estate is a prime example. Easy money via manipulation creates the mirage of easy times. And there was a banker in the 1800s who once famously stated that when you manipulate interest rates below what the market dictates, everything that comes down to valuation will develop an aspect of bloat. And that today is what we would call a bubble. Yeah, monetary manipulation by central banks, it means that investments are made that shouldn't be made. Buildings are built that shouldn't be built, and massive risks are taken on because there's no perceived downside to the risk. Too much is poured into unproductive works, and it becomes a setup for a very troubling end. We know this from history to be true. The governor of the Bank of England in 1889 warned the City of London with the following quote, "The present tendency of finance is distinctly in the direction of danger. Too much capital is being forced into industrial developments. Financiers are taking larger and larger risks, and an increased number of investments have been driven up in price by the combined effort of a long period of cheap money and depression in trade. We have most of the elements of a crisis." Does that sound like today? Yes, manipulation comes with a price. This is a good point in the episode to highlight that although we've been discussing manipulations by governments and bureaucrats and players in the capital markets and central banks, there is a gatekeeper and protector of truth out there that's become a willing accomplice by not calling out the obvious manipulations as they occur. And that gatekeeper and the sort of protector of truth is supposed to be the discipline and profession of journalism and the media. Now, I was reading a piece by someone who recently did an excellent job of surmising that a journalist is a person ideally who was willing to destroy their own opinions in the face of facts, and someone who's willing to report the truth regardless of any consequence to the journalists themselves, and someone focused on reality instead of desired outcome. Now, that's not what most journalists in the media do today. Instead, they become betrayers of their legacy and their responsibility within society. Most journalists today, they do the opposite. They let their opinions trump the facts. They report the image instead of the truth, and they focus on ideology and desired outcome instead of reality. Time to bring our episode of manipulation to an end. We covered a lot, made some very interesting connections. Let's close with the connection to what I believe might be the greatest song in the history of rock and roll about manipulation. It's by an LA group formed in the early 1950s who became one of the most successful vocal groups of the early rock and roll era. The group was The Platters. And the song that focused on manipulation was their number one hit, their first number one hit, The Great Pretender. Its lyrics were written in the washroom of the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas by Buck Ram. Buck Ram was a legendary songwriter who inked many of the Platters' hits. And the song is about self-manipulation. It's a powerful variation of manipulation or form of manipulation, as we all probably know from firsthand experience. And the opening verse is historic rock and roll, constant listeners. Oh yes, I'm the great pretender, pretending that I'm doing well. My need is such, I pretend too much. I'm lonely, but no one can tell. Play some of the Platters' greatest hits. Another smash single that hit number one for the Platters was Twilight Time. That's my favorite song from the Platters. And it's Twilight Time for this week's installment of The Far Middle. Don't forget, we don a new episode, Milestone number 150, next. And that should be fun.